In this episode of the Story Brand Podcast, we interview Dan Carathy about his new book, If I'm Being Honest. Hello, dear podcast listeners. In this first English episode of the Story Brand Podcast, we interview no one less than Dan Carathy. You may know him from the programs on television, So You Think You Can Dance, or Holland's Got Talent, where he is a judge. But you may not know everything about his career, and you may not know about his personal life. I had a very, very interesting and very honest and open conversation with Dan. And I know that you will like this conversation because of his brutal honesty about his life. And we can learn so much from somebody who is open and honest and tells it like it is. You know, you almost wish that you have more open and honest conversations like the one I had with Dan. I think we talked about almost 2 hours, and we also had a lot of fun. We decided to keep the first part of the podcast in it, where I made the mistake of not recording. So you will hear Dan laugh out loud about the fact that I made that mistake. But it's a wonderful conversation. It's a conversation about the real life. So let me introduce to you Dan Carathy, and then let's go to this first English episode of the Story Brand Podcast. Dan's career started as a dancer on Broadway and on award show stages with Britney Spears. After transitioning to a choreographer, he worked with Britney Spears, NSYNC, Jessica Simpson, Kylie Minogue, Justin Timberlake, and Usher. Although he quickly became known for his work dancing and choreographing for pop music superstars, Carathy broadened his reach with powerful dancing and cutting-edge choreography in commercials and events for iPod, Best Buy, Mattel, Dance Central 2, Miller, Xbox Kinect, IKEA, and many more. In 2005, So You Think You Can Dance debuted in the US with Dan as a judge. After 3 successful seasons, he took the format to Europe, where he became the Simon Cowell of the Netherlands and Belgium, leading judging panels for numerous talent shows. Dan, with his effortless cool brand, made his acting debut by starring in Soof, the number one film franchise in Dutch history. Despite keeping his personal life private and his effortless cool brand, Dan took the brave step of sharing with the public his lifelong struggles with anxiety and alcohol. Dan is a doting and devoted father and husband that made mistakes due to his struggles. In addition to releasing another film and returning to the judging panel of Got Talent in 2022, Dan launched a podcast which explores recovery, and he debuted with his first book about his life that details his career and his struggles. Here is an open and honest discussion with Dan Carathy.
We have to start record, so I have to start over. Sorry about that. I forgot the button.
That's mine. I might as be as nervous as you when you went to Michael Jackson.
You didn't
I'm so
hit
sorry.
Record.
Never happened to me,
dude.
Before.
That is so fantastic. Like, are we recording now?
Yeah.
If there's a way to mix that in, yeah, you totally should. Because I can't tell you how many podcasts I've done, and at the end, someone has gone, "Oh shit, did I hit record?" That's fantastic.
Yeah, it is.
But good that you noticed it in the first, minute and a half.
Yeah.
Then after we spoke for an hour.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's do it again.
Yeah,
okay,
let's do it again. That was a good warm up.
This seems like a repetition in your dancing, you know?
Yeah. You gotta have the dry run, man.
Over.
Always.
Well, where we started this with the flips, the cover of your book, it says on one day in the middle of the pandemic, you are driving through your beautiful hometown. Now I'm gonna try to say it again. Wyckoff.
That's right.
New Jersey.
Yep.
And you're on your way to the liquor store to get some drinks for the night. And as usual, you are listening to a sports program on the radio. And that's when you hear a phrase that really touches your heart. It says you are truly the man you are when no one is watching. It took a couple of seconds for it to sink in, and then the tears came and you had to pull the car to the side of the road. And the 30 minutes that followed, you describe as being irritated. On one hand, you had to weep uncontrollably, and on the other hand, you were wondering, what the fuck is going on with me? For the first time in years, you saw the man you had become, the real you, and you found him terrible. You hated him. What has happened to me? Now, before we dive into your story, because this is the turning point in your life story, so to say, your book would not have been there if there was not a point where you changed. But please share with the listener, who is Dan Carity? And before we hit the record button, I was asking you about your career, but you say, no, there's more important things in my life. So please share.
Yeah, well, way more important is that I'm Dan Carity, the husband and the father.
Yeah.
Which is not the way I used to introduce myself.
No.
But I've recognized that that's way more important to me than anything else I've done in my life. As far as my career, I started as a dancer.
Mm.
I danced on Broadway. I danced with...
Because your parents were on Broadway too.
They were. Yeah. You know, my parents were both Broadway dancers and we kind of have a bit of a dancing family. My parents owned a dance studio in New Jersey that I grew up around. So I was always kind of around the entertainment business a little bit and in the dance world, but I never thought I would have a career in it. It was a hobby. But
you just love doing it.
I enjoyed it. I was good at it.
You never thought you were going to be a professional dancer?
No, I had never even remotely considered it. I loved soccer first. I was a soccer player.
Wow.
And I was...
Pretty unusual in the U.S.
By New Jersey standards, I was a good soccer player. I don't know by European standards. But I went to college thinking I was going to play soccer.
Yeah.
And about a month in to being in college, I realized, yeah, I'm not that good at soccer. Not as good as I thought I was. I'm never going to have a career here.
No.
So I'm done with this. And suddenly I found myself missing dance. And so I tried to get right back into it, tried to find places to take classes, still thinking of it as a hobby. I was a journalism major while I was in college.
Yeah.
And I always enjoyed writing. But, you know, right place, right time, taking a bunch of dance classes, met people. That's how I ended up in Footloose on Broadway, my first Broadway show. And I met choreographers who started working in the music industry. And before I knew it, I was dancing for Britney Spears. And I ended up moving out to LA and had a career not just in dance, but also in choreography. And that took me to different places around the world. And then they launched So You Think You Can Dance in the US.
Yeah.
And I got hired as a judge and a choreographer on that.
Wow.
Which was... career-wise, a huge turning point for me.
Yeah.
Taking it from behind the scenes to all of a sudden being on camera.
Right, because you were on stage with, for example, Britney Spears dancing. Was that before you actually started also teaching people like Britney Spears, Jessica Simpson?
Yeah, dancer first.
Dancer
first. I was
first.
A dancer first. Yeah. And then, you know, through people I met in the dance world, I started to be an assistant choreographer and then eventually choreographing myself.
Yeah.
And then that choreography career took me into So You Think You Can Dance.
Yeah.
And then So You Think You Can Dance took me around the world. One of those places being the Netherlands.
Yeah, right.
And the show's popularity here led RTL to ask me to continue doing more shows.
Yeah.
There was never any plan of having a career here in the Netherlands, but
it just happened.
It just kind of happened. And before I knew it, I was here for like 3 months out of the year.
Yeah. Which is interesting to me because maybe we jump a little bit ahead of things. But one of the things that struck a chord with me reading your book is that you shared in your book, I never really made a choice for things. They just happened and continue to happen. A real pathway of success. Somebody in your book, you describe somebody saying you have an unnormal career path.
Yeah, in English you'd say an anomaly.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's kind of unexplainable.
Yeah, but you know, a lot of times when we look at successful people like on television, just like you, people might think, man, he's got it. But because everything happened naturally and pretty fast, you still had you came to your senses at a certain point, is this what I want? Is this who I am? You still have to...
Yeah, it's...
How does that work?
I call it like I was riding a wave.
Yeah.
Right? And I just didn't get off. I never got off the wave to even look at what I was doing or decide, is this even what I want to do?
Yeah.
The danger, and I consider it a blessing.
Yeah.
In certain ways, because...
Now, you're grateful for it.
I'm so grateful for it and for all of the opportunities that came my way and everything I got to get to do. And I was working very hard, but a lot of right place, right time things happened for me. The danger in it is that I was never wondering, do I enjoy this? Do I want to do it? And I started to attach the success of it to material items. And I saw my bank account getting bigger.
Yeah.
I was able to afford nicer places to live, nicer cars, nicer clothes. And I got caught up in that to the point where I wasn't even paying attention to how cool the opportunities were anymore,
right?
Where I was getting to go or who I was meeting or who I was working with. It was all about, well, how much am I going to get paid for that?
Yeah.
How much are you going to get paid for that? What a horrible way to navigate your way through things. Yes, we all want to make money.
Right.
But I made that the be-all, end-all, you know, and that's what I was working towards. So I was taking the jobs that were paying me the most.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the ones that I wanted or enjoyed.
Wouldn't you say it's easy for a young man or woman in that world to end up in such a place? You know, because...
Yeah,
but it sounds pretty understandable.
Yeah, I think, you know, what happened for me, as I said, I was working hard, but usually people are forced to pay their dues for longer periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, for instance, as an assistant choreographer, which I was able to get into that very quickly.
Right.
But you usually have to work for years as an assistant before you start choreographing your own stuff.
Yeah.
I think I did it for like 6 months.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And I was choreographing my own stuff.
Yeah.
You know? And even with So You Think You Can Dance, I mean, most of the people that got hired to be judges and choreographers on that show were people who had been in the industry for years.
Yeah.
I had been there for like 3 years.
Yeah.
You know? It happens so fast.
They went by car, you by rocket.
Seriously.
Yeah.
You know, and so again, grateful for it, but never even thought to stop and take a look at how awesome this was.
Yeah.
And also say, do I enjoy this? Which part of it do I enjoy? Let me go for this or go for that. No, it's just, you know, what else is next? And that's what happened. Instead of learning to enjoy what I was doing,
mm-hmm.
I was constantly thinking, all right, let me finish this job. Because what's next?
Yeah.
What's next?
Yeah.
What's next? Never sitting in the moment.
Right.
And saying, wow, this is amazing.
Like,
look where I am.
No,
look what I'm doing.
Contemplation.
None.
No.
And no sense of enjoyment or fulfillment from what I was actually doing.
Yeah.
I was so concerned with where it was leading, what was coming next.
A human doing instead of a human being.
Yeah.
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 So, okay. Well, you know, one of the things that you share, and you start your book actually by stating that you had it all but lived with a secret. And that must have been really tough, because I was reading it and it really started pretty fast. You know, when you went to LA and you began to have success in things, you share in chapter 2 of your book about the alter ego. To me, that was like... I've never have anybody described it like that, but I felt like, man, I think every human being on this planet can recognize what happens there. So can you explain to the listener, what do you mean with an alter ego, and how did it make you survive, actually? So it brought success in some ways, and then it also brought a lot of pain.
Well,
So what is it?
I think we all have... Not all, I shouldn't say that, but most of us have the person we are at work and then the person we are at home.
Yeah.
And there's overlap. Some of the real you is that person at work.
Yeah.
But also there's ways you act and things you do and things you say at work that that's not who you are at home. You're much more relaxed.
Right.
And just a different all around vibe.
Yeah.
For me, I started acting. I was hanging out with these Hollywood people, these, you know, big New York people.
Yeah, young.
And at a young age, yeah. I was, you know, 18, 19 right. years old. And so I started studying everything that they would do. The way they walked, the way they talked, the way they dressed, all of those different things. And I started trying to mimic them in my own way.
Yeah.
And that's okay, right? It's
yeah, there's nothing wrong about that.
I don't know if Justin Timberlake is as cool at home as he is when you see him out in public. I would like to think he's not. Can't imagine someone being that cool all the time.
You've been to his home, so.
Yeah. But, you know, that there's a certain point where you shut it off, right?
Yeah,
And I did for a while. I would act a certain way, but then I would come home and I would just be me. And then at a certain point, I started to act that way all the time.
Yeah.
And I think that's the difference,
right?
It's like everyone has that alter ego of who they are at work.
Yeah.
But I got to a point where I stopped shutting it off. Mm-hmm. And I started playing that character all the time. And it didn't matter who I was around, my family, my friends, whoever my girlfriend may have been at that time, anybody that was around me.
Right.
I was trying to be this person.
Yeah.
That I thought.
Trying to be cool.
That I thought I wanted to be and that I thought everybody else wanted me to be.
Right.
Yeah. I was trying to be cool.
Yeah.
And I would tell people, if you asked me, oh, how is this going or how is that going?
Yeah.
I wanted you to think that I was living the life. Now, I was to a certain extent.
Actually, you were.
But I exaggerated everything.
Yeah.
I exaggerated every relationship, every moment, every opportunity, every performance, and pretended like it was the best thing that ever happened. And so I was trying to act that way. I was trying to convince you that that was happening. And I...
Your talent in overdrive.
Yeah.
So to say.
And, you know, they call it wearing a mask. Like, I started to wear this mask. Mm-hmm. But what happened is I stopped taking that mask off.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, I blurred the lines between who I really am
right.
and who that guy at work is.
Right.
And I lost all ability to identify who is who.
Yeah. So you lost sight of the real person, the mm-hmm. real Dan, and the alter ego that we all have, so to say.
Yeah.
So they blurred into each other. And so why, you know, because... It helped you in some degrees, but in some ways it became a problem. So when did you realize, my goodness, I'm really in trouble?
No.
Not?
Not for years.
No.
I mean, not until recently, right? It's like that only grew over decades.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't until...
Okay, let me put it in.
It wasn't until how you started this conversation by saying that day that I was driving in the car and I heard that quote, the real man is the one you are when no one is watching.
Right.
And I just started to look at, holy shit, I'm not the guy that I've made everybody think
right.
I am.
Yeah.
But I'm also not the guy that I used to be.
No.
I had become someone that I did not like.
No.
I didn't like, because I was a husband and the father at that time.
Right.
And I did not like the husband or the father that I was being. I didn't like the friend I was being. I didn't even like the colleague I was being. You know, it's like I would act a certain way at work, but I didn't like the interactions that I would have with people. I was lying to everybody. I was pretending that my life was a certain way.
Yeah.
I wasn't developing any relationships. And that's what I noticed.
Right.
In that moment, I started to recognize, God, I've built no meaningful relationships in my life. Mm-hmm. None. No long-lasting friendships. Nothing. And even the relationship I had built with my wife was beautiful in certain ways, but it was also a lot of it built on lies.
Yeah.
And the relationship I was having with my kids, it's like I wasn't even letting my kids in. I was even playing a character in front of my children, trying to make them think I was a certain way or a certain person. It sounds crazy when I'm saying this out loud right now, but there was nothing authentic about what I was doing on a daily basis with anybody.
No. So, but still, you know, when we talk about truth and lies, and when things begin to blur and you don't really know who you are, what's true and what's not, how do you get back to the true self?
You gotta strip it down. I mean, I had to be stripped down.
Yeah.
And it started in rehab.
Yeah.
You know, that stripping down.
The 12 steps.
Yeah. It was, well, first it was getting off the booze.
Yeah.
Right, because drinking had just allowed me to numb out and not think about anything.
Right, but because that's an interesting thing, because in the same chapter where you talk about the alter ego, in some ways you saw it was a problem because you had to use alcohol to quiet down the voice of one of the...
Yeah, but I didn't realize I was doing that.
No.
Think about this. That started when I was 18, 19 years old.
Right.
I didn't recognize that until I was at rehab in my 40s.
Really?
Yeah.
So you did it?
I started to
dig. It just happened.
In journaling. Yeah, I was just doing it. And I started, when I started journaling and going back in my life and trying to trace where did this all come from, I recognized that's where I really turned on those weekends when I was 18 and 19 years old and teaching big, you know, thousands of kids
the VIP
and hanging out with these Hollywood types. And that's when I really started to try to play this cooler version of myself. It was exhausting.
Yeah, of course.
Right. But I would do it all day long. And then all of a sudden, as tiring as it was, the best way to come down from that at the end of the night was to have a couple drinks.
Yeah, to have some relaxation because it's like being a full-time actor. And then you have to have something that cools it down if you can't shut the brain down.
So
the mind, I should say.
I mean, even now I'm sober. I am not someone, I can't go shoot Holland's Got Talent and then come home and get into bed and go to sleep.
No.
I can't do it.
No.
I need at least a couple hours to bring it down after that show. Now I do it in different ways. One of the best ways is I talk to my kids on the phone, and that feels great. And it brings me back down. It grounds me again, brings me back to real life.
Yeah.
One of my unhealthy ways, but I enjoy it, is I eat a lot of ice cream.
Yeah.
So I'll turn the TV on and I'll eat some ice cream. And yes, I know that's another addiction, but it's not as bad as drinking, so I'm okay with it.
My personal trainer said a while back, I lost 14 kilos the last month.
Good for you.
The personal trainer, and he said, Don, you just have to choose your addiction.
Yeah, it's true.
Let it be a healthy one, you know, because even the sports, he said, when I'm in doing my CrossFit and everything, he said, that's my addiction.
Yep,
so absolutely. In some ways, we have to have a place where we can let go.
Yeah, but the problem with me is that I found that in alcohol.
Yeah.
And I didn't recognize that it was unhealthy.
No.
I didn't see it. And, you know, now when I look at it, God, it's so glaringly obvious.
Yeah.
But I didn't see it then. I thought of it as just, hey, this is an easy way to end my night, make me feel good, bring me back to zero.
Yeah.
And then I go to sleep and I wake up and do it all over again the next day.
And in some extent, it worked.
It worked brilliantly.
Otherwise, you would have stopped way before that. So that's the problem with these things.
Yeah. Also the danger with me, and I don't know if I'm going to throw you off.
No, go ahead.
But the danger with me too is that addiction runs in my family.
Yeah.
Right. So there are a lot of people I think in this world who probably could do that.
Yeah.
They could have that drink or two every night, but that's where it ends.
Yeah.
And they go to sleep and good for them, and that's fine.
Yeah.
The addiction in my family, I mean, there's a long line of alcoholics in my family, a brother, a sister, a grandparent, and an aunt. We have gambling addicts in the family, all of that. So I think when I turned on that switch of turning to alcohol, I couldn't turn it off.
Yeah.
And two led to three, led to four, led to I can't stop until there's nothing left or I pass out.
Yeah, so there is something with generations. There's something with DNA. You can be vulnerable to these things to a certain degree. And I think people that know a little bit about it and how this works understand that. So it's not about willpower.
No.
So when you went to rehab, so was that your biggest fear? Am I going to succeed?
Well, I want to talk about willpower for a second because I think that's important, you know, because there are people out there who
they think
doubt my story to a certain extent. And they're like, you're weak. You don't have any willpower. You know, I had willpower in every aspect of my life.
Right.
Imagine getting wasted every night, but being able to drag yourself out of bed and go to the gym at 6 a.m. every morning.
Yeah.
Because I could do that.
Right.
I think that's pretty good willpower.
It is.
I think.
Well, your manager.
I ate an almost perfect diet. That's willpower. Like I could exercise it in any other part of my life, just not alcohol. So do I think it's genetic? Hell yeah, I think it's genetic. Yeah. I think there's other things in there too that we've been talking about.
Of course. Yeah, you don't say it's genetic because you want to be a victim.
No, not at all. Not at all.
But you have to be real about where things come from.
Come on. I mean, there being that many addicts in my family, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
It's like there's something there.
Yeah.
And, you know, from my time in rehab and in 12 steps and all different meetings and meeting all these different people, and you hear about their lineage and how it's run rampant, you know, addiction is run rampant through their families as well.
Right.
There's something to that.
Right. So willpower is something that you have. Everybody has willpower, but it only can go to such a degree.
Yeah.
It's not the saving security thing.
No.
That's going to stop somewhere.
No. It's you know, and I think this willpower that I have and the discipline that comes along with it has benefited me greatly in recovery.
Right.
You know, there's this saying that chase your recovery like you used to chase the drink.
Yeah.
You know, and I do that.
Yeah.
And I have a ton of discipline and willpower around my recovery.
Right.
And I think that's why I've been successful so far.
Right.
I'm also not stupid. I could slip up at any time.
Right.
But I know I have to wake up every day and I need to do these certain things if I want to stay sober and keep living this beautiful life that I've discovered.
Let's talk about that, because you just mentioned something that we passed by real quickly, but you said about journaling and getting insights to your own behavior and life. How important has been journaling?
It's everything.
Is it something that they say in rehab, do it, or in therapy?
Yeah, so it was like day 3 or 4 in rehab, and they said, you know, they give you a pad and a pen, and they were like, we want you to start journaling. And I thought, this is stupid, right?
But that's not for me.
But okay, right? I'll do it. And by the second day, I was ripping off pages every day.
You couldn't write fast enough.
Yeah. Just digging through my life and starting to recognize, having all these aha moments of just realizing, oh my God, this happened then and this happened then. And now I'm connecting the dots through my life and realizing what got me to this place. And it's, you know, we talk about how I pulled my car over on that day and had this, what happened? How did I end up like this guy?
Right.
And journaling and rehab helped me connect the dots and figure out how I ended up as that guy.
Yeah, and you need those answers in order to write a different story from there.
Well, what happens in rehab is they get you off the alcohol.
Yeah.
They got me clean.
Right.
And they introduced me to the 12 steps.
Yeah.
They introduced me to journaling. They introduced you to these different things, but after 31 days, you get thrown back out into the real world. And hopefully you got a little bit of head start and started to figure out, and you just said these things like journaling and everything, that to recognize what happened, how I got here and all this, so that you can still search and figure out and grow and learn about how you need to be moving forward to avoid this again.
It's interesting. Jim Rohn, the mentor of Tony Robbins. Tony Robbins, as a little kid with his terrible background, came into this meeting room where Jim Rohn was sharing. And I heard Jim Rohn, I listened a lot to his tapes, and one is about journaling. And he says, there's something about putting something on paper, because we are more true to ourselves about our past, our present, and our future if we write it down. Because if you keep the thought in your head, you can still twist it a little bit.
Yeah.
But when you write it down, that's it. So you're pretty, it's the most honest place where you can be.
Yeah.
Probably when you journaled, there were times where you said, I don't want anybody to read this.
Oh, yeah. Especially when I was going home. It's like, I was like, if my wife gets a hold of this journal, this is not going to be good for me.
I'm in trouble.
But it's so true. The thoughts in your head, at least the way my brain works,
yeah,
you get jumbled up sometimes and you start to have a thought about something, but then boom, it bounces to something else. And you don't get all the way through that thought process. When you write, I mean, when I start writing down, if I'm on a specific subject, I just keep writing on that subject and diving deeper and deeper. And that's when I started to recognize
these
things.
It's a mirror.
Yeah.
It's the honest conversation with yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
So isn't it fearful to go into rehab? Wasn't your biggest fear, how am I going to keep on pressing on when I'm out of rehab? Or was it more like a journey? How long were you in rehab?
So I was in rehab for 31 days.
Okay.
And I think the overwhelming thought was very simple for the alcoholic that I was, that I am. The overwhelming thought entering rehab was, my life is over. I am never going to have fun again. It was that simple.
Yeah.
I thought, I'm never going to have fun. I am going to get clean.
Yeah.
And I'm never going to drink again.
But it's over.
Because I'm doing that for my wife and my kids.
Yeah.
But me enjoying my life, that's over. And that was the hardest thing to get me to go, right? It's, I understood for a long time, years, that I had a problem.
Right.
I didn't want to stop because I just could not understand what life would be like without it.
Yeah.
I thought, it's over.
Yeah.
Everything that I find fun, exciting, enjoyable life in life is gone when I stop drinking.
That's actually terrible, actually.
Yeah. So that's why I couldn't find a way out. No. Right? It's like, how am I supposed to live without this stuff that I drink every night? And that was the thought going in.
It has become a part of you.
It's your best friend.
Yeah.
It literally is your best friend. It's there for you.
Yeah.
When you're sad.
It's tearing up your most intimate relationship with somebody.
But it's your buddy.
Yeah.
It's there for you when you're sad, angry, happy. I mean, when I think about it, if I had the best day, let's have drinks. Worst day, let's have drinks. If we're going to a party, let's have drinks. If I'm home by myself, let's have drinks. It's in everything.
Yeah.
So it's there by your side. And to give that up, it's like saying goodbye to your best friend or to your spouse or your brother or sister.
Yeah.
It's been there with you.
Or for a parent, never seeing your children again. It's something disastrous like that.
Yeah. So
what happened then?
So,
because you came home with that thought.
Well, No.
Oh.
See, I got rid of that thought in rehab, and it actually didn't take that long. It was very strange. I was there for a couple of days. You're in detox. They're detoxing you, but I was responding really well. Okay, let's let him go down and listen to some meetings. So yeah, you can go down to the first floor and you can sit in on a couple of the 12-step meetings or just the guys talking. And I remember hearing from outside the room, heading towards the room, all the guys were laughing. And just hearing that laughter surprised me. I said, what are they laughing about? And I walked into the room and half of them were smiling. They're joking around with each other. And I found it shocking that they're enjoying each other and the conversation. And how is this possible? How could they possibly be having fun in rehab? What I discovered was that the next 31 days of my life were the best days I had lived in years. And I was laughing every day. I was smiling every day.
Yeah.
I felt like $1 million. And it was a very strange feeling because I didn't know how to explain it to my wife. The few times we got to talk on the phone,
right.
How do I tell my wife what a great time I'm having in rehab? Right? It sounds weird.
Yeah.
And I think part of her fairly wanted me to be miserable.
Yeah, of course.
You know?
Yeah, now you're going to pay the price.
Yeah. You know, you're getting what you deserve. Actually, I was loving it because I was connecting.
Yeah.
And I was talking to people.
Yeah.
And I was saying all of my shit out loud. And they were listening and they were saying stuff back to me. And
they understood you.
They understood. I thought I had found my people.
Yeah, your tribe.
And I, for the longest time, I felt isolated and alone because I thought no one could possibly understand what it's like to be me.
Yeah.
And I realized they all understand.
Yeah.
They all understand exactly what it's like. Because it didn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, we started talking about my career and all that kind of stuff. None of that mattered.
No.
We all had the same stuff going on in our minds, no matter where we were from,
is that
what we do, how much money we make. We were all the same. It was crazy.
Isn't that your biggest revelation, maybe?
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, I want to jump to this place where you went with your friends, with your wife, the four of you eating in Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking with each other, and at a certain moment, your wife says, like, yeah, but then in your family, nobody really talks about the real stuff. You talk about politics and about all the other things going on and facts, but not about the real stuff. And I don't know if it's true, but it felt like you were a little bit agitated or something, you know, like, hey, this is a pretty strong statement about where I come from. It's about your family.
Yeah.
And then you've realized she may be right. And I think, you know, you share in your book, you say, we need to talk about our fears, our gloom, our issues, our problems, that of a friend or a family member, and the deeper things of life. And the reason I bring it up right now is because you just shared, I'm in this rehab, I always felt isolated. And now for the first time, actually, you're talking and you made this expression, the listener can't see it, but you made your arms go like this, like, I'm just,
I'm
you know,
free.
Pulling it out.
Free.
Yeah, free. But free because you could share.
Yeah, because you could say how you were really feeling.
Yeah.
What's really going on. You're doing a little bit of self-discovery.
Yeah.
It was fantastic. And, you know, you talk about that night with my wife at dinner with another wonderful couple that I'm still friendly with.
Mm.
My wife pointed that out and you said it. I was taken back when she said, your family doesn't talk about anything.
Yeah.
What?
You wanted to disagree.
It came up because the other woman was talking about what a wonderful relationship she has with her family. And so then I was saying, oh yeah, me too.
Yeah.
But the woman was talking about her relationship with her father and everything that they talk about. And I was thinking we do the same thing. And then when Natasha, my wife, pointed out that you guys don't do that. What are you talking about?
Right.
And then I got annoyed. How dare you say that?
Yeah.
How dare you talk about my family that way? And especially in front of other people.
Yeah.
And so we went home that night and like everything, I asked a couple questions to Natasha, and she basically reiterated what she had said at dinner. But then I just, instead of thinking deeper about it and really digging in, it's like I kind of crushed the conversation.
Right.
But then the more I thought about it, I said, oh my God, she is.
Yeah. And
she's spot on.
And she didn't say it to hurt you.
Not at all.
Or to embarrass you in front of people. For her, it's a different thing.
Yeah. It was just something that she always noticed.
Yeah.
And so she was just pointing it out very matter of factly, like, right. Oh, yeah, you guys scream and yell and carry on about sports and politics, whatever. Yeah, but there's never a, how are you really doing?
Yeah.
What's going on?
Yeah.
And when I started to look at that, when we had family members, grandparents, aunts and uncles that we were very close with pass away, sometimes we went to the funeral, sometimes we didn't.
Right.
Which is strange in and of itself. But whether we did or we didn't, we never spoke about it afterwards. There was never talking about what they meant to us, reminiscing about them. There was nothing. So there was no closure, but there was nothing about trying to take in that moment and the gravity of that moment. We also never spoke. I mean, a perfect example is when I got out of rehab, a couple days later, I go to my parents' house and we're in the backyard and my mom says, you know, how are you? You okay? And I said, yeah, I'm doing all right. And she said, everything's okay? I said, well, yeah. I mean, you know, I just got out and I got a lot to do and to figure out, but I'm doing okay. It's great. So glad you're doing well. And that was the end of the conversation.
Wow. Very confrontational.
Yeah. And in that moment, I was like, oh man, there it is.
Yeah.
You know, there it is.
Yeah.
And my family, we all still hang out all the time. We all take care of each other, look out for each other.
Yeah.
But
so
there's no real deep conversations.
So this is, you know, we have the same age. I recognize, especially the last few months, I've been thinking about my own family life. So how do you deal with that? Because there is, you love them unconditionally. You know, they're your family. They're part of your DNA. But at the same time, to become real and say, okay, this is really great about my family, and this is something I want to do different in my life. So where, how do you have to give it a place, because, you know, at this moment that you have this conversation in the backyard with your mother, you're expecting something different.
And oh, no, I wasn't.
No?
I kind of knew that's what it was going to be.
Okay.
I have, you know, I do it, I handle it in different ways now.
Yeah.
First, my parents are wonderful people. They're the best. They've been so supportive, and they're much older. You know, my dad's in his 80s. My mom's in her late 70s. They kind of are who they are, and that's okay.
Yeah.
And so my expectations, I just have to, you know, keep them in check.
Right.
I have a sister who's in recovery who we actually dig in a little bit more now.
That's cool.
We force each other to dig in a little bit. So we're making progress in our relationship.
That's rewarding.
I have a brother who's incredibly spiritual, who has played a huge role in my life. Hmm. But now we really have wonderful conversations.
That's
where
amazing.
We never did before. Yeah. So I'm making a concerted effort to have a better relationship with them than I did.
Beautiful.
It's not possible with all of them.
No.
Some of them I've tried.
Right.
They don't reciprocate much. Okay.
And that's good too.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
But I know in my house with Natasha and my kids, we talk.
Quinn and Daniel. Yeah.
We talk almost to a fault right now, maybe a little too much sometimes.
Really?
And I try to be careful not to, you know, push my kids too much. I don't want to be, I want them to have a normal life, and I don't want them, I got to remember how old they are. But we try to keep the door wide open for them to talk about anything and everything.
And the younger generation is also, it's different for them as well. I've noticed that they are way more open.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think because, you know, like a lot of us, like I say, well, my parents, they're a product of their generation. That's how they were brought up.
It is.
So that's how they are. That's fine.
Yeah.
You know, we are as 47-year-olds a certain way.
Yeah.
Again, product of our generation, but we're also learning, or I am, from a generation younger than me.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to learn from them and be better based on what I see them doing and trying to do some of that for my kids.
Right.
And I think I've been successful so far in that.
Yeah, that's amazing. So I've noticed you like reading.
Yes.
At least what I heard from you. And one of your books that you shared is like Ego is the Enemy.
Mm.
And has been really key in your life. Ryan Holiday, it's Stoicism, the philosophy of Stoicism. Can you elaborate a little bit what the book or the idea, or what is it that really helped you in that?
Yeah, so I read that book twice.
Yeah.
And the first time I read it, most of it I read when I was on the airplane and in hotels, and I was drinking while I was reading it.
Yeah.
And it got me thinking, but eventually the alcohol would take over and I would put the book down and I wouldn't give it any further thought.
Right.
I didn't let it really sink in. And when I was leaving for rehab and I'm packing a small little duffel bag, because it's all you're allowed to bring, something told me, that book was sitting in my desk. I don't know what, but something told me, throw that book in your bag. Now, by the way, at that point, it's not like I read that much.
No.
I was on a downward spiral for years. Occasionally I would read a book, but I wasn't reading a lot. But something told me to bring that. And I started reading it second or third day there. And then I started highlighting and underlining and rereading and started to recognize all these things that were going on in my head were very normal.
Yeah.
Happened to a lot of people.
Yeah. Isn't it freeing to read the book?
Oh.
Because it's really about, it's really straightforward.
And it, not just freeing, but also when it explains it to you, it makes you aware of it. And when you're aware of it, you can fix that behavior.
Yeah.
And I could turn some of those thoughts off. Instead of drowning in those horrible thoughts, I could switch them off, redirect the way I was feeling.
Yeah.
That was huge.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, as I was saying, that the biggest thing was recognizing, God, somebody else has gone through this. You know, this whole imposter syndrome thing.
Yeah.
I think so many people suffer from that.
Yeah.
I never understood that before. I never knew that before. No. I thought I was the only one.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's so much of people who suffer from mental health.
Yeah.
But I know as alcoholics and people with all kinds of problems, you get into this place where you feel like no one can understand you, and you get into this woe is me
isolation.
Very much
isolation.
Yeah. And you isolate.
Yeah.
And that book made me realize, God, it's, I don't need to. There are people out there who will understand exactly how I'm feeling. And it also explained to me, you shouldn't be feeling this way.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, maybe I did build up my reputation beyond what it should have been. Maybe I did. I actively did that. I know I did. And we can talk about that. But I did do a lot of good things.
Yeah, you did.
Both as a person and in a career. And I should be proud of those things.
Right.
I shouldn't be looking at everything as, I was lucky to do that. I was lucky to do that.
No,
I was lucky.
No.
I was lucky for some of it. But I also worked my ass off for some of it.
Yeah, you did.
You know, and starting to recognize all of that too, and come from a place of being a bit more grateful for everything that had happened for me rather than being in a position where, man, I didn't deserve that at all.
Right. So, you know, when you mentioned that point of isolation where you had the feeling, I'm the only one on earth with this problem or with this thought or with this feeling, I would like to ask you about your vision on friendship, because what I find really interesting that you talk a whole chapter about your manager, who actually is one of the most important persons in your life. You even said in rehab, I had two phone numbers with me from Natasha, your wife, and from
Michael
Sanchez.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's this unconditional part in friendship where people take you as who you are. And I see in your book, reading your book, it's been really an important relationship, friendship, you know. He knew what was going on, left it most of the time because he saw you were performing well, mm-hmm. like you said before, a few minutes ago, where you said, like, hey, getting wasted at night, but then performing. And sometimes he didn't let you go with it.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us, you know, why is it important? Because I feel like isolation, especially with men, I see, I'm not a woman, but if I only look at my wife and how she has friends and how they're open with each other way more easily than we men.
Mm-hmm.
And at a certain moment in my life, I thought, I will never have a friend in my life where I can truly be myself and celebrate the good, but also share the stuff of the fears and the anxieties. And I have a friend like that now, and it's really important in my life that I have, you know, it's really new to me. It's a new sensation, actually, to have a friendship where you...
It's insane.
It's like a lifeline.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah.
And I never recognized, first, I didn't recognize that the few friendships that I did have in my life were all based on drinking. I didn't have any real friends.
No.
Now I still speak to them. I still care for them. We're still very friendly. We don't hang out anymore because I don't even know what we would talk about if we hung out. You know, like we send memes back and forth to each other and we talk about how the Giants are doing and, you know, that's our relationship and that's cool.
Yeah.
I think I need that in my life too.
Yeah.
But I had one real friend.
Yeah.
And it was Michael.
Yeah.
I didn't recognize that then, that he was my only real friend. But as it turns out, I mean, he really was. He knows everything about me.
Yeah.
Everything. Maybe in some ways he knows more about me than Natasha does, you know, but he was there for me in every way, almost by default, right? He was good friends with Natasha.
Yeah.
He introduced me to Natasha.
Yeah.
When I would have trouble in my life with Natasha, I had no one to turn to because I didn't talk to my family about those kind of things.
No.
I had no real friends to talk about those kind of things.
Right.
But Michael knew Natasha.
Yeah.
Now it was self-serving how I would turn to him because if anyone could help me, it was him. He was friends with her. So when she was done with me because of my drinking problem and the, you know, bad nights that I would have,
right,
I would turn to him and say, please fix this for me. Please help me.
Yeah. Save me.
So he knew because of that, that's one of many examples, but he knew when things were going badly in my life.
Yeah.
And he knew when things were going well.
Wow.
Both on a personal and a professional level.
Yeah.
He would hear about my ugly behavior from drinking, from Natasha. Nobody else knew about that, but he did.
So not judgmental.
Not judgmental. He, no matter what happened, no matter what he heard, what he saw, what was going on.
Right.
We would hang out together and we would just sit and we would talk.
Yeah.
And much like with my family and stuff, he and I would talk sports, politics, all that kind of stuff. But then we would go deeper. And he would ask questions about Natasha or I would ask him for help. And I didn't even recognize how important that relationship was to me until I got sober. Right. It's like he was there for me every possible way.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that I turned to him always.
Yeah.
Because if I needed advice for work, if I needed to celebrate something, if I was torn up about something that I saw in the news, if I was having trouble with something with my family, and then obviously with Natasha, as a dad, everything, I turned to him. Luckily, he's a very smart man, so most of the time he gave me good answers. Occasionally, he would lead me astray. But he and I had brutally honest conversations with each other.
Yeah.
And he would call me an alcoholic to my face.
Wow.
And I say this in the book. He would say it in jest, right?
Yeah.
He would say it as a joke.
Yeah.
But there was truth behind it because he knew.
Yeah.
He watched when he and I would go on business trips together, when he would come to the Netherlands with me. He saw me every night.
Right.
Drinking.
The good, the bad, and the ugly.
So he knew.
Yeah.
But
he never deserted you.
He would tell me, yo, dude, you got to, you know, be careful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Watch what you're doing. But same kind of thing. And I was good. I was performing. I was there. I was showing up.
Yeah.
I was doing what I needed to do, as we say, to keep the trains running.
Yeah.
And so he only pushed so much.
You know, the title of your book is "If I'm Being Honest." You know, when I finished the book, I felt like brutally honest could have been the title.
Because
you're really open about all the things going on in your life. And then there comes this chapter where you say, I'm really ashamed to share this. And I felt like, okay, now I'm going to get a revelation that's going to be, you know, this is going to be... I almost felt my heart pounding because You know, I can imagine if you want to trust the paper with this, with something in your life that you're ashamed of, it's going to be. And but you already shared everything, and then you talk about the sweat hands.
Yeah.
And so, why was that such a hard thing to share in your life? Because it feels like something very small to me.
Imagine if you couldn't shake hands when you walked into a room. Imagine if you couldn't high five a buddy when your team scores. Imagine worrying about your kids not wanting to hold your hand because daddy's hands are icky. And then tell me it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
That's how it was for me.
Right.
The shame and embarrassment over it.
So it's really about intimacy with other people, actually.
Yeah.
And not being able to do so.
I couldn't.
No.
I couldn't. So I would, hours before I had to go somewhere, I already was thinking, plotting how I was going to enter the room
and avoid it
and greet people and avoid having to shake hands.
Wow.
So that would haunt me 3-4 hours before I would even go somewhere.
That's a lot of stress.
Actually. And then on the way there, thinking about it and then walking in and thinking, all right, where are my hands at right now? How wet or dry are they? Can I get away with a handshake? Can I not get away with a handshake? And then God forbid if I chose to, or if I got forced into one, because if someone walks towards you and extends their hand, what are you going to do?
Right.
So if I shook the person's hand, then the rest of the time I was there, and this is part of ego is the enemy, right? The rest of the time I was there, all night or in a meeting with executives or wherever I may have been, I'm sitting there thinking about what are they thinking about my hand?
Right.
I thought you were thinking about it all night, that it dominated your thoughts. You were wondering, why was Dan Carradine's hand so wet when I shook it?
Yeah.
Chances are, now I realize, you probably forgot about that.
Right.
20 yeah. seconds later. I thought you thought about that all night long. I would come out. They would introduce me at So You Think You Can Dance. And I'd come out on stage and I'd wave to the audience. And I'd walk up there and I would do my best to fist bump people, right? But occasionally some kid would extend his hand and I would have that moment of, should I or shouldn't I? And if I did, I promise you for the rest of the show that night, while we're recording the show, I'm looking at that kid wondering, what does he think about me right now? I would think yeah. about that the whole time. I'd fixate on that.
Yeah, so it's something you couldn't control.
I couldn't control it. It dominated
everything.
Everything.
Yeah.
And it only got worse. And it came along with the anxiety, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
my hands would sweat. It would give me anxiety. The more anxiety I had, the more my hands would sweat. Mm. It was just vicious. And then the alcoholic, by drink three, my hands were dry.
Yeah.
And they would stay dry all night.
Yeah.
And I loved that.
Yeah.
So get me a drink as fast as you can.
So we all, in certain degrees, have issues in our lives that are completely stupid in the eyes of somebody else, but very important for ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, I remember as a kid being in school, whenever there's biology and it would be about sex, my face would get red. And I felt like, okay, so it became red before the subject was talked about, you know? And I thought everybody would see it.
Yeah.
And I was trying to get out of biology classes just to get out of this situation where my face would turn red. And the only thing, it wasn't even about the subject. It was more about what would people think.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we all have, to a certain degree, some things in our lives where we feel so uncomfortable. And it has to do with anxiety. It has to do with fear. It has to do with something. So you, obviously, your position in life, where a lot of people see you on television, they might think, okay, he's got everything together. Because we always tend to think that successful people on television have no issues at all. And so we feel even more stupid on our couch at home you know, and rejecting ourselves because we know all our little secrets.
Mm-hmm.
And then you coming out with your book about your addiction and sharing the whole story and even about the sweating of the hands, I think it's really important that we talk about these things.
Well, it's also everything you're talking about right now and like the little things about yourself.
Yeah.
You know, again, this is part of ego is the enemy, but we're all so concerned with what other people yeah. think about us.
Continuously.
Who's thinking about you?
Nobody.
Nobody.
No. Like,
I was obsessed with what everyone thought about me. Everyone has their own yeah. lives, their own problems, their own things to
I'm
worry
not sure
about.
Which is worse, by the way.
You know, I know, right? But it's what's funny about this is like you're the first person to ask me about the sweaty hands. And this shows you the ego. I mean, is yeah. I can read all the books I want and I can do the work that I do every day, but I'm still human.
Yeah.
That was the hardest chapter for me to put in the book.
Yeah.
Because it was just admitting something that I was still ashamed of.
Right.
And still embarrassed. No one gives a shit.
No one gives
Nobody
a
comments
shit.
On that chapter. No. Nobody asks me about it. And I'm like, God, I thought that was going to be such a revelation. And to your point, most people are probably like, who cares, dude?
No.
You know, but it mattered to me.
Yeah.
But what has helped me is realizing that, you know, my problems are my problems. Most people don't think about them.
No.
And your problems are your problems. I'm busy.
Yeah.
When we finish here today,
yeah.
I got a bunch of other things I need to do.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm going to go
it
on
was
with
a
my
moment.
Life. And so are you.
Yeah.
But man, I didn't see it that way.
No.
I thought that you thought about me
all the time.
The time. And not in a good way, right? That's the strange thing about the ego. I always thought before ego meant that you think you're, you know, the next best thing.
Yeah.
Right.
But that's not at all.
I thought I was the worst
yeah.
next thing. And I thought you were thinking about it.
Yeah.
You know, it's such a horrible place to be in your head.
Right.
Because also it forced me to live constantly not in the now.
Yeah.
I was everywhere else.
Right.
I was never just sitting in the moment. Enjoying anything.
Yeah.
I was always worried about who I saw before or who I'm going to see next and never just enjoying
yeah.
sitting here,
yeah.
having this conversation. Like
yeah.
I could sit there with you and talk to you all day long now, but I never could have done this before.
No.
Because I didn't want to be in the moment like this.
Right. Too confrontational.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, then you describe your relationship with Justin Timberlake, your friendship with him, and you're working with him. There's an interesting thing that you share where you say, I began to realize that, you know, when he needed you and being open and vulnerable towards you about some things in his life, people have to read the book to know what it is, but now you realize I wasn't there for him. I was just saying to him, hey, get over it. You know, it's going to be all right. So this ego thing or whatever you want to call it then, it did not only rob you of your personal relationship with yourself where you, you know, didn't give yourself the attention and what you needed, but it also extended to your relationships. And on the other hand, with the people you describe that we all only know from television, you had relationships with them, like Jessica Simpson. You also share that you really had close relationships, you know, you shared, especially with her, I think you shared a lot of vulnerable stuff because she was vulnerable with you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not all black and white.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe you can share with the listener, because I felt like it's an important life lesson for all of us. If we are too much focused on our own shit and at the same time not really focused on our own shit and dealing with it, because, you know, that's the two systems of the ego,
yeah.
then we're not only robbing ourselves of something, but maybe our kids, our spouse or our friends or our colleagues from an experience. They don't get everything that we are. That they need.
Yeah. I wasn't there for anybody. It's interesting. You bring up Justin now after we just said about we watch these people on TV and social media and we think they have it all figured out or everything's okay.
That's what we think, artificially.
Yeah, and I think part of it is what they put out there. You know, for instance, myself, I made everyone think that my life was perfect on social media.
Yeah.
And I feel bad about that, by the way, because I was guilty of that same thing of putting out an unreachable goal from people. Look at me and my perfect life.
Yeah.
Come on. You know, it was like I was lying about everything. You know, so I don't feel good about that. But like someone like Justin, you know, you watch him from afar and you think he's got it all. But obviously this was a long time ago, but he was Justin Timberlake, lead guy from NSYNC, dating Britney Spears. You know, sky is the limit for him.
What else?
And he's crying to me about his relationship with her. And I offered him nothing because I was so consumed with myself and my own shit. And everything was about me. And I looked at that situation as, I can't believe this is happening to me. Not this poor guy. Is because what he was asking me about was he was having problems in his relationship with Brittany, and I knew what was going on in their relationship. I knew that Brittany was cheating on him. I knew these things.
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe that I had been put in this position. That's how I looked at it.
Right.
Poor me. How unfair is this to me?
Yeah.
Meanwhile, this guy
is hurting.
All he's doing is looking for some help, some advice. He's hurting and reaching out. And I gave him nothing, you know, and I look back on those times with such remorse because I think about those years that I, for so much of my life, I've had the opportunity to travel, work with incredible people, meet incredible people. Yes, some famous, some not, some producers, but all kinds of interesting people over the world.
Right.
And I developed no friendships, none, nothing long lasting, no one that I'm still in contact with because that was all me. I had multiple people reach out to me on countless occasions. Hey, let's go have dinner. Hey, let's go have a drink. Hey, let's go do this. Let's go do that. And I said no to everything because God forbid I have a real conversation with someone.
Right.
I was incapable of doing it. So I was incapable of being a friend to anybody.
Right.
You know, you bring up Jessica. Jessica and I had a different kind of relationship for me at that time because she was going through some stuff in her life. And so she was so open and honest and vulnerable to me about all of it that it just opened the door for me. And for some reason in that instance,
you could.
I could.
Yeah.
And I did.
Yeah.
And we developed this beautiful relationship with each other.
Right. By being vulnerable.
By being vulnerable. Again, I didn't recognize that at the time. I knew that I was loving this relationship I was having with her and how close we were growing together. But I didn't recognize what I was doing that made this one different.
Right.
I didn't see that at all.
No.
And unfortunately, I ended up blowing up that relationship like I did every other relationship with my alcoholism and my behavior, my selfish behavior like that.
Yeah.
But I missed out on relationships from the time I was young. People I grew up with, kids in high school, kids in college, and all the way through my life and my career. Again, this is one of those things I'm so fortunate for what I've gotten to do and travel and meet worldly people and interesting people and developed no relationships.
So how has this, because you're sober now, I think it also, it's very courageous for you to write the book, but really to become vulnerable with your wife, with your kids, with your family is the most important one. How is this all changing now in your life? What is it bringing about? Because I also saw on your Instagram account, you say, my mind is still getting more clear. And I also want to ask you, you know, what would you say, would you suggest to people to just stop drinking, even if there's no alcohol addiction. This is maybe a hard topic, but, you know, it's an interesting thought.
Sure. There's a couple different things you asked here.
Yeah.
First of all, I think I'm a bit immature emotionally. I think I stunted my growth emotionally with drinking for so long and lacking those personal relationships that I'm playing catch up now.
Yeah.
So I don't think I have the emotional maturity of a 47-year-old man. I'm not even going to say how old I think I am emotionally, but I have so much room to grow.
Right.
And so I'm learning every day. What I've done is, and I say this all the time, is I have opened up to the world, and I feel like the world has opened up to me.
Yeah. You're getting a lot of letters, you said.
So first of all, in personal relationships, there are people just in my immediate orbit, people I've known for years, but that I've never given any time to, that now I'm growing really close to.
Wonderful.
And having wonderful conversations with. Both family members, my nephew, for instance, I talk about him all the time. He's still a kid. He's 22 years old.
Wow.
But our relationship has just blossomed. It's incredible. But also other dads in our neighborhood that I have real conversations with. Moms who come up to me who have had drinking problems of their own. Yeah. We have long conversations with that. It's like, it's fantastic. But beyond that, relationships I'm building at work. It's amazing. But then since I started my podcast and since writing the book, the amount of people from around the world that reach out to me and share their story and we get into conversations, some of them I talk to on the phone, some of them just over emails, some incredible conversations just on DMs, on Instagram. It's mind-blowing how connected I feel.
It's a big reward, actually.
It's everything.
Yeah.
It's, you know, everything starts at home. And the relationship I have with my wife and kids now is beyond anything I thought it could be. But there's still so much work to be done there, especially with my wife.
Yeah.
But I'm in it and I'm loving it because I feel like every day is bringing about more of me,
right,
and better versions of me.
Yeah.
So what I'm learning at home and what I'm learning from strangers and everybody that I talk to on a daily basis it's changed my life. It changed my view on other people, on myself, everything.
Right. So what's the next chapter for Dan? What are some of the things that, because this is really opening up a whole new world and new possibilities for yourself and new views. So what are some of your big dreams that you have? Like, because, you know, at a certain age, you also think about why are we here?
Yeah.
What is the reason of all of this? And how am I going to make sense of it all or put purpose into things?
So I think, first of all, on a personal level, as I said, I have so much room to grow. And you and I were talking about this briefly before we started recording. There are things about myself that I think Natasha and me thought would go away when the drinking was gone.
Yeah.
But it turns out they don't go away. Turns out this is kind of who I am. One of those things being I'm quite selfish. And that's one of a few things that I find that I really need to work on and I'm actively working on.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with that. I'm okay with accepting that I'm not perfect,
right,
that I'm far from perfect, and that I need to do the work to try to be better.
Yeah.
And where I used to, if something was pointed out to me in the past that was less than perfect, I got defensive and I pushed it away and I didn't pay any attention to it. And now I listen.
You almost dive into it.
And I'm like, how can I learn why I'm this way and try to be different, to be better than that. And I'm all about that. I'm all about that. As far as, you know, beyond that, as far as purpose.
Because you obviously have a stage.
I really liked what I did for a living. I really liked it.
Yeah.
I still do. I still really enjoy doing the television shows.
Yeah.
Did I really love dancing? I don't think so. I think I really liked it.
Mm.
I liked the escape it gave me. You know, where I was someone that was so in my head, dancing allowed me to be in the moment.
Yeah.
It's the reason I love to go to the gym so much.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you can have so much going on in your day, and you can think about your problems that are going to be here tomorrow that you need to solve, and your problems from yesterday that you're trying to solve. But when you're in the gym, the only problem you have to solve is, how am I going to get through this workout?
That's it, huh?
So it's in that moment.
Yeah.
And I think dancing gave me that as well.
Yeah.
I was in that moment. So I think that's what I really enjoyed with it. But when the dancers that I know that are lifelong dancers, there's a passion for dancing there. I don't think I have that. I don't think I have that love. I think what I did for a living all these years, I really liked.
Yeah.
But what I'm doing now, talking to people, I love.
Wow.
And so I've always had this gift of communication.
Yeah.
I'm happy to say that.
Yeah.
I'm confident in saying that.
Yeah.
I think that's what made me good as a judge on the shows.
I wanted to say that, because I think that's the amazing part about this whole story, actually, also. You know, when I read your book and when people hear you now on the podcast, I can imagine, okay, but you say you didn't talk about the real stuff, but as a judge, being able with empathy to really strike a chord with people, I think you gave a lot of power and a lot of truth to people on the stage that went way beyond just judging the very moment.
Yeah, well, the beauty in those moments, and I think what saved me in all those shows, was that the focus for me, one of the things I always did as a judge, because I think it's the proper way to do it, is the focus should be on the contestants.
Yeah.
My job is not to look at me, look at me, look at me. My job is to talk about them. They're the ones doing the work, right? So I think that I was focused on them. It allowed me to get out of my head a little bit. And like, who's looking at me? Who's thinking about me? All that crap that we talked about. And just put it on them. And I was able to express how I feel about what I saw.
Yeah.
And I always felt good about the way I did that. But I always did it in the context of the shows.
Yeah.
I never did it beyond the shows.
No.
And I always felt like, I'm using this gift of communication, but I'm using it selfishly. I'm using it for myself.
Really?
It's a way to make money. It's my job.
Yeah.
And who am I really helping? Maybe I helped some acts here and there, but who am I really helping? Now I feel like I'm helping people.
Yeah.
I've never done anything that's been this rewarding.
Right.
And whether it's writing the book or it's on the podcast or it's just talking to people.
Yeah, or giving a presentation like last night, you know, where you have this whole room of people and pouring it out on them.
I love that.
Yeah.
I can't get enough of it.
No.
I can talk for days.
Awesome.
And it makes me feel good. It's all therapy for me.
Yeah.
Right? It's like the more I can spill and share.
It works both ways. That's where you end the book. You know, there's two reasons you wrote the book. One is for your own therapy, and one is because you want to truly help other people in their journey. So I think it's always a communicating vessels.
Mm-hmm.
It's always two sides.
And it's, I want to do it in a way, I want people to feel like I get you.
Yeah.
I want them to get me, and I want them to know that I get them.
Yeah.
I try to be raw. I try to be real. I don't prepare for these conversations or anything. I don't try to sound
smart,
philosophical, eloquent. I just like to say, here's what happened.
Yeah, just like in your own podcast.
I want to use
giving it the real deal.
I'm not trying to give advice either. I'm trying to, here's what happened in my life. Here's my experience. Yeah. Maybe you can relate.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to do.
So if you could dream and anything is possible, has there been a glance in your head where you thought, my goodness, if I'm getting these DMs, I'm having these real conversations, I'm seeing how people are responding to the book, is there a step on the horizon where you say, if I could do that, and maybe you don't even want to share it, that's good too. But I'm just, you know, because you are really, it's all over you. When I see it on your face when you talk about it.
So I want to do what I'm doing.
Yeah.
On whatever scale it can be done on.
Yeah.
Right. So if the podcast can be bigger.
Yeah.
Great. But I still want to do the podcast.
Yeah.
You know, and if I can take that format and do it in other ways, that's what I want to do. But right. I want to bring people on who have incredible stories and help them share their story.
Yeah.
That's what I want to do ultimately.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm realizing things as well. Like with my nephew and a few other people, we did an Ironman. Right.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Everyone that I brought onto my team is going through different things.
Right.
Right. So everyone's in recovery. One woman's grieving from a loss of her husband. Another person is dealing with health issues as a result of a heart aneurysm bursting. You have my addiction issues. You have my nephew's OCD anxiety issues. And we used the Ironman as sort of the backdrop for us trying to move forward in our lives. And I never thought I would do an Ironman.
No, it's amazing.
And I never thought I'd bring a group of people together
and
to try to
together.
Learn from each other, support each other, grow together, and maybe take that next step in our life. But that's what we did. So what else is going to come along like that? I don't know.
No.
But I bet you I'll have another idea, you know, by 6 o'clock tonight. And I'm like, let's try that.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's where I am. I'm in this place.
You're just enjoying it.
I'm excited.
Yeah.
I wake up every day with, what do I get to do?
Yeah.
You know, and what else can I do? And who else can I reach? And I'm just loving it.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Cause I wanted to ask you about being fit and healthy, because that was really something in your book as well, where you say, hey, I need to put my energy there. You just talked about the gym and how that's actually also therapy. I recognize that. I never liked sports. I was always working and obviously not taking care of my body. And now this morning at 8, I had my gym session, and it's love and hate at the same time, because I know my personal trainer is going to be very hard on me.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at the clock, and I think it's only going to be another 40 minutes. And at the same time, I'm loving it. So how is this health thing, you know, this, and obviously you're in a great physical condition, but you really took that to a next level.
Well, how do you feel? You know, you have that love, hate, I get that. But how do you feel when you come out of the gym?
Perfect. Just, I don't want to miss that feeling. I know, and I do it for the feeling.
You feel like you can conquer the world, you know?
Yeah.
And then reality sets in again later, but you feel great about yourself.
Yeah.
And hopefully you can get past the, you know, however many weeks it takes you to get past the, this is a grind, and you start to look forward to it eventually. But the whole fitness thing, you know, I don't need to get into the scientific part of it, but we all know it's better for us to work out than not.
Yeah.
It's better for us to eat healthy than not. But mental health wise, man, it's
a game changer.
Even when I was in the darkest of places, that hour or 2 hours, whatever it was, that I would spend in the gym each day. Thank God for
that. Lifesaver.
Thank God for that. It would get me out of my head. It would take care of the anxiety because I wasn't worrying about tomorrow
right.
or worrying about yesterday. I was actually in the moment and working out and feeling good.
Yeah.
That was huge. And beyond all the health benefits, knowing now like that I can get that every single day. All I have to do is go to the gym or go outside for a run and it gets my head right.
Right.
It gets me into that right place.
Yeah.
Everyone should get to enjoy that.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't, whatever you consider your workout,
right?
Go for a walk.
Yeah.
Whatever it may be, you don't have to do a freaking yeah. Ironman. I mean,
or that's, cycling.
By the way, the Ironman, like that's the addict in me, right?
Yeah.
That's me turning my addiction to something else.
Yeah.
I'm aware of that.
Yeah.
Right. But better for that addiction than the other one. But I feel like everyone needs to move.
Mm.
Moving is good for your body. It gets your mind right. It sets the stage for everything else.
It's present you need to give yourself.
And I promise you, it rolls over into other things.
That's it.
How you feel about yourself coming out of the gym will roll over into how you feel when you walk into a room.
Absolutely.
How you feel at your job. What the food choices that you're going to make.
Yeah.
It goes over into everything.
It is.
And if you're a parent, the example it sets for your kids, that's huge.
Yeah, it's huge.
You know, it makes your kids want to get off their video games or get off their phone, and they're going to exercise too.
Yeah.
You know, so you'll have that ripple effect.
It's
beautiful.
That
ripple effect is so important.
Right after I came out of the gym this morning, we had field hockey with my second daughter. And I think in May, when I started losing weight and really working out with some guys, you know, if it was in May, this parent-child hockey tournament, I would have felt so miserable to go onto the field. And now I felt like, man, I just went straight from the gym in my clothes to the field and I could play two matches. I wasn't exhausted. You know, I heard a dad say, oh, we're exhausted. And I thought, not me, you know, I'm doing good. So it's really, it really spills over into other parts of your life in a big way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it not only makes you feel good,
but
makes your child feel good.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's one of the things I believe in, you know, wholly is that, you know, your kids don't learn from listening.
No.
They learn from watching.
Right.
You can tell your kids until you're blue in the face what they should do.
Yeah.
They're not going to listen to you eventually.
No.
You know, maybe they will right now, but eventually they're not going to listen to you.
Yeah.
They're going to learn from the example that you set. You know, and I'm very aware when I say this, of the example I was setting for a long time. You know, you better believe my kids noticed when daddy wasn't drinking wine anymore. They pointed it out and they were well aware. I thought my kids have no idea. You know, I'm not hurting them. This only hurts me.
Yeah.
They have no clue. Oh, they knew because the minute that wine was gone, they pointed it out.
Wow.
So don't tell me my kids didn't notice.
Yeah.
They knew well what was going on. And it was only going to get worse as they got older, right? It's like, luckily they were young enough that they didn't exactly see the mood shifts
right.
and all of that, but they saw the presence of the alcohol all the time.
Yeah.
And now they recognize that it's not there and they recognize how much I work out and my kids are crazy active. And I just think, you know, that whole thing of that the kids learn from watching you, we all should take that to heart, whether it's how hard you work or how you treat your spouse or the friendships,
or them, how you
the
treat
friendships.
Them.
Like for instance, isolator. I'm an isolator. My kids see that, you know, that's not a good thing to teach your kids.
No,
that isolating is, you know, that you should know, you know, you need friends.
Yeah.
You need communication.
Yeah.
And I was not showing them that at all.
Right.
So, you know, what I'm showing them now, and I have a ways to go, but is way better
wonderful
than what was being shown.
Two last questions.
Wait. I didn't answer a question from earlier. You asked about
your vision.
Should I not think that people, Like, what do I think about people drinking or not?
Yeah.
Should they? You know, I'm very careful with this.
Because, I understand.
Well, I don't want
the
anyone
to... The reason I ask is because when I listen to your podcast, you're brutally honest about things. You dare to talk about things nobody talks about. And, you know, it's interesting that your son is called Daniel. And that's my real name, too. And there's, you know, I was raised in a Christian family. And you know, from a biblical standpoint, for years I thought, okay, there's the book Daniel. And when he came to this strange country, this strange king, they were ordered to eat stuff they couldn't eat as a Jew. And he said, okay, let's do a test. I'm going to eat healthy and I'm going to drink healthy. And after 10 weeks, you judge. And the king saw their appearance and it changed. You know, it was healthy. It was way better than the other. So the king said, we're all going to eat like Daniel and his friends. And there's this specific Bible scripture where it says, it doesn't fit a king to drink. And so for years, I was not drinking alcohol because of that sentence. And then later, you know, in life, I began to drink alcohol and I love a wine or a beer. But, you know, preparing this podcast and reading your book, I wanted to ask you this honest question. What is your vision about it? Because obviously the benefits of not drinking, and I have more friends in my environment that say, hey, I quit and I feel way better. So this is honestly not for the listener. This is maybe even more a question from me to you personally. What would you suggest? And maybe I can already think about the answer, but it's an interesting thing, you know, because it's one of the things in our society that we all accept it as being part of our society. But maybe we should second guess that.
Well, that's what you just hit on right there. Bingo. Because why do we have to involve drinking in every social event? Why?
Yeah.
Why can't we go to dinner without having a drink? Why can't we go watch our favorite football team without drinking beer? Why? I can tell you that the producers of the alcohol, the big companies, you know, they market it as, you need this to have fun.
Yeah.
Well, I bought in. I mean, like, that was me, you know? And I think
their campaign works for a while.
I think the majority of people can drink responsibly.
Yeah.
You know, if you're a couple and you're going out for a romantic dinner together,
right?
You should have some wine together and enjoy your meal, and good for you. I think that's fantastic. But if you're going to dinner 2 days later with your kids, do you need to drink at dinner? Especially if you're going to get in the car and drive home. I'm not judging. What I'm saying is those are the things I think we need to think about.
Yeah.
I know it's awesome going to a football game. I always did, and having beers, right? But at a certain point,
yeah,
drinking the beer, I was drinking the beer before, during, and after the game. It became more important for me to drink the beer than to actually watch the game. Why?
Yeah.
Right? I think commercials, movies, you know, it's movies and TV are huge on making you feel like if you're celebrating something, you should have a drink.
Right.
You know, how many shows or movies, think of how many scenes you've seen. You're having a tough day. They walk into their house. They walk right over and they pour themselves a drink. Really? Why? Because I can promise you, science will tell you that drink doesn't make your bad day better.
Right.
It's actually going to make it worse.
Same with coffee.
You know? It's like, so I think we should be aware of the fact that we have woven drinking into everything. Mm. We've made it acceptable in every environment. Maybe it's not. There are definitely places that it's okay. And if you're someone who can drink responsibly, more power to you. But we've turned it into this culture of
right.
We drink
right.
All the time. everywhere, it's probably not the best thing in the world. It's not good for our health. Mm. It's certainly not good for our mental well-being.
No, our mind.
I mean, if you're depressed and you drink, I promise you tomorrow, you're going to be more depressed.
Yeah.
It's just, that's science. That's what's going to happen. You know, so, but we've been told that that's what we need.
Yeah.
And we buy into it.
Yeah.
So I think we should just reevaluate the importance of alcohol in our life.
Great.
You know, I wish that I could have a drink, you know, at a certain event or to celebrate with the boys. You know, it's, I always talk about when my daughter gets married, whenever that may be, I can't toast a glass of champagne.
Right.
That sucks.
Yeah.
But that's me. It's something I have to deal with and I'm not going to be able to do, whatever. Yeah. If you can do that, good for you, and you should. But think about all the other places that you do it in and maybe second guess whether that's the best thing for you and for your kids.
Yeah. But then how to deal with it? Because if we would be friends and you would come to my home, because that's also the social becomes asocial.
Mm-hmm.
So with our events, for example, in our company, we are on a point where we say, do we really have to have champagne when everybody finishes our workshop? Or should we have an alcohol-free drink? And the reason being is the last time I did this in Amsterdam, we're going to have a four-day event next week. There was somebody in the room that really pointed this out to us. And I felt awkward because I thought, okay, man, this is, you are honest about your issue and we didn't think about it. So it's also really, you know, like you said, maybe it's more like a private thing when you are with your spouse, go out to eat. How do you look at the asocial social? Because,
well, I'm careful on that, right?
Yeah.
It's my problem. It's not your problem, uh-huh. right? So if your company, if I was invited there and I was coming in your company, everybody wanted to have a glass of champagne afterwards, more power to you. That's not your problem. You shouldn't have to be worried about my feelings.
Okay.
Not at all. And if I'm invited to a dinner party, like I make sure, I tell my wife this, I go, please, please make sure they understand this. Or if I know the people, I'll shoot a text and I'll say, please.
Don't worry about it.
Do not worry about it.
Yeah.
Like, it's okay. It doesn't bother me.
You don't want to bother anybody with it.
It's my problem. It's not like I don't like when people push their problems on somebody else or another group of people. I have a drinking problem. You don't. If you feel like drinking, more power to you.
Right.
You know, I have to make the decision of whether or not I'm going to put myself in that environment.
Yeah.
Now I'm in a place now where it doesn't bother me. If you were having a drink right now, I don't care. If I'm going out to a party or something, I don't care that everybody's drinking. Now, when people start to get drunk, I will tell you, I have no time for that.
No.
As far as for me,
right.
It's so annoying to me.
And
I'm sure other people who just don't drink that much, it's probably annoying to them too.
Yeah.
I was the drunk guy, by the way. So I get that, you know, it's so annoying.
Yeah.
That's when I remove myself.
Right.
I'll say to my wife, all right, time to go.
Time to go.
You know?
Yeah.
But it's
good that you point out both sides.
Yeah.
Because
but it's my,
we never talk about these things.
Yeah. It's my problem, right? It's not yours.
Yeah.
So I would never expect somebody to adjust their behavior for me.
Right.
You have no reason to do that.
No. I'm going to ask you two more questions that I ask everybody that's on the podcast. But before I do, is there anything that you want to, that we didn't cover or that you would really love to share to the listener before we're going to the last two questions?
Oh, man. I don't know. We covered quite a bit.
Yeah, we did.
We really did. It's, you know, I think the biggest thing is that I just like to impress upon people.
Yeah.
Is that connection, that sharing.
Yeah.
Whatever it is.
Yeah, I felt that through this podcast, actually.
You don't have to be, we all have issues. And no matter what your issue is, no matter what it is, talking about it with the right person can make it so much better.
Yeah. Relief.
You know, whether that's a spouse or a friend or a therapist or someone.
Yeah.
You know,
or even a stranger on an airplane. Sometimes that
Maybe.
If that's where you are.
But just don't keep that right. shit bottled up inside.
Right.
Because that's when you end up in a bad place.
Yeah.
That's what ultimately took me down.
Right.
Was just keeping it to myself all the time because I wanted everyone to think
yeah.
that I was okay. And I wasn't.
No. That might be their biggest revelation going in therapy, hearing those guys laugh, reading a book, The Ego is the Enemy, and seeing, hey, I'm not the only one. So from isolation to sharing.
Yep.
Okay, the last two questions. One of them is, if all the billboards in the Netherlands would be yours for a day, what would Dan Carity share with this country?
We just said it. Talk.
Talk. Love it.
Say it out loud.
The shortest, that's the shortest version I've ever heard. That's, I love it. And
But it's so true.
It is.
It's no matter what, because good, bad, indifferent.
Right.
Right? It's yeah. share.
Share. Yeah.
Share. And you don't have to share it loudly if you don't want. You could share it very quietly to someone important in your life.
Right.
Or you can, you know, scream it from a rooftop. That's up to you.
Beautiful.
But share it.
Yeah. And the last question, and maybe you've already answered this one, by the way, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What book do you want to recommend to any listener to read? Of course, we need to talk about your book for a second also, because we're going to give 10 copies away, signed copies. So if you listen to this podcast and you heard Dan's story, and you want to get a copy of his book, we're going to sign 10 copies. They're here on the table. Just send a message to contact@storybrand.nl and tell us why you want the book.
For me, the book, I talk about it in my book, but I talk about it all the time, is The Obstacle is the Way.
Yeah.
Same author, Ryan Holiday. We all face obstacles in our life at different points. Sometimes when we're young, sometimes when we're older. It could be a person. It could be health. It could be an addiction. It could be so many different things. But we all run into things. Sometimes we get stuck in life. Could be your job. Could be anything. And what that book explains is that your approach to these obstacles, and that so many of us, and I know myself, I approached my addiction as this wall.
Yeah.
And I needed to hide it. I couldn't let anybody know that I had this problem, you know, and keep it to myself. And instead, embracing it, saying, yes, this is my addiction, and I'm going to own it and use it as a place of power. That's what the book talks about. And no matter what you're running into, you know, there's a lot of teams who use this book to help you get through a tough season.
Wonderful.
And they read the book and it talks about how you can come together as a team and how you get through things. But ultimately, everything is about, you know, embrace the bad as well.
Yeah.
Don't run away from the bad. Don't try to get around it, under it, over it. Embrace it.
Yeah.
Talk about it. Talk about it with whoever's around you.
That's where the breakthrough
is. Use it
as
a source of power.
Yeah. Beautiful. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much, Dan.
Yeah, thank you. I really enjoyed this.
Yeah. Wonderful conversation.
Yeah. All right.
All right.
I hope you have enjoyed this first English conversation with a guest in the StoryBrand podcast. More to follow. I hope you have enjoyed this brutally open conversation with Dan Carity. And just take your time to write us an email and get a hold of a signed copy of his book. And I hope to see you and hear you next week. Thank you. Bye-bye.